Hey, friends, welcome back to Anti-Visions. Well, just as I said last week, we're going to pick up on Surveillance Capitalism, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. I started a small series on her book because I believe that it's really important to understand some of the underlying things that are happening. And although it might at times seem a little bit complicated, I think there really are patterns that we can pull from it. I am by no means doing an in-depth summary of her book. It's more of a synopsis. And today I'm going to focus on another aspect that she actually doesn't really talk about very much. She only devotes a handful of pages to it, but it's the Chinese surveillance system. Because in China, they have a social credit system and a surveillance system that work together. And I believe that it's an incredible example of what she calls surveillance capitalism, which is why I'm a little surprised she doesn't talk a lot about it. But I think it's really important. So I'm just going to explain it a little bit for those who have maybe never heard of it or you've heard a little bit about it. I'm going to just explain a little bit and try to make some connections to why it's relevant to this whole idea of this new form of capitalism that has emerged and the idea that we've been talking about, which is data harvesting. So several years ago, China, I don't know how many years, but it's quite some time ago, they began to implement a social credit system, like I said, that rates citizens based on their behavior. And they have well over 300 million cameras. From what I understand, that's enough to have about seven cameras for every citizen. I've heard that there's even more now. Either way, it's an amazing amount of cameras. And although the surveillance apparatus that the CCP, that's the Chinese Communist Party, regardless of the fact that they might call themselves a democracy, it's actually still a communist country. So the CCP developed this surveillance apparatus in China, and this apparatus should cause a chill in our soul, is what I'm arguing. And that system would not be possible without the data harvesting practices that Zuboff's book talks about, because they implement those same practices. She briefly mentions China's social credit system in a section called The China Syndrome, on pages 388 to 394. It's a scant 6 pages. But like I said, that's surprisingly all that she mentions. She even seems to discount the relevance of the Chinese expression of surveillance under the pretext that they aren't a democracy. I seriously disagree with her on this point and hope that she has come to change her mind since the book's publication. So I'm going to play a little clip from Tech Vision, who did a little segment on their social credit system. So I'm just going to play this and then comment a little and then probably play a couple other clips as well.
Imagine a world where everything you do, from meeting your friends to using a public toilet, is recorded. Based on your actions, ranging from what you buy to where you go, you are given a score similar to the way you rate an Uber drive. If the government believes what you do is socially beneficial, the score will increase, and if not, the score will decrease. If you critique the government, buy alcohol or play games, your score decreases. And when your score is low, you won't be allowed to travel, your children would be barred from applying to high school, you would be fired from your job, and the best part, you would be publicly shamed. This dystopian future is a reality of today's China. According to People's Daily, China's facial recognition system has become so advanced that it can scan the faces of 1.4 billion Chinese citizens in just a second.
I'm just going to interrupt here because I want to point out and encourage us just to keep in mind that the way that China is able to have this effective social credit system is that they have mass surveillance and massive data harvesting, like I was talking about in the last episode, where they're pulling in massive amounts of data, analyzing it, and using it for mass surveillance. But they use it to proactively social engineer their society, which is what this social credit system is for. So I'm just going to play a little bit more of this clip to give a vision of what it's like.
China calls it the social credit system. Whatever you do from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed is recorded. Based on your actions, your social credit score increases or decreases. If you praise the government publicly, donate blood, help the poor, engage in charity work, etc., your score increases. If your score is high, you'll get tax breaks, free gym, preference at hospitals, and if you do something which is considered to be wrongful by the government, the opposite happens. Due to the social credit system, people fail to look at the bigger picture as they are constantly busy improving their scores to avail the benefits which come with it. The ratings for every Chinese citizen are publicly available, and anyone can see them, completely eradicating their privacy and ruining their social life. If you raise your voice against the government, your score would decrease, and other people wouldn't know why your score is low. They might think it's low because you did something wrong, so they'd want to stay away from you. Soon, due to the fear of lower ratings and what others would think about them, similar to what happens on social media, citizens will refrain from any kind of independent expression, both on social media and real life, as this might lead to lower ratings, leading to a denial of basic human rights for them.
Okay. Well, I have personally seen several news clips and stories on the social credit system where Chinese citizens have been interviewed, and many of them, at least in the interviews, gave positive feedback and said that they really like it because it's made them feel safer because they know that there's total surveillance around them. But a lot of them have said it's made them a better person morally because they, you know, they'll be penalized if they make a snarky comment on social media or if they jaywalk or if they do anything minor, like just a minor traffic incident. So they feel like it's made them more moral, or at least the people who were interviewed. And they also think that it's made people behave a lot better in general. Of course, you have to wonder, well, if it's all externally controlled, then that doesn't necessarily mean it's making people more moral. They're just being ruled or coerced into proper behavior. Now, some may imagine that something like a social credit system would never be implemented in the West, especially not in the United States. But we're already primed for it in so many ways. Here's an excerpt from Zuboff's book talking about the social credit system in the U.S. She says, Chinese users are rendered, classified, and queued up for prediction with every digital touch. And so are we. We are ranked on Uber, on eBay, on Facebook, and on many other web businesses, and those are only the rankings that we see. Chinese users are assigned a character score, whereas the U.S. government urges the tech companies to train their algorithms for a, quote, radicalism score. Indeed. Okay, so I'm just going to stop there for a moment. So like she's saying, there are multiple ways that we're measured. First of all, obviously, we have social media, and that's, everybody knows that. We see that. But then there are these other scores that we don't think about. But like she said, you know, scoring for radicalism, like right-wing radicals or white supremacists or whatever they might be, domestic terrorists, those kind of things. But there are also, I'll get to it, there are also other scores like ESGs, which I don't even think she mentions in her book. But she does go on to also mention that even Facebook hinted at interest and even filed a patent at one point in time with the intent of basically having a service that's connected to banks and financial services so that when people apply for a loan, part of that process is that your social credit score would be checked by these banks. And we're talking social credit as in Facebook and Twitter and all these places, and that would actually be part of the process of deciding whether you actually get a loan. Now, that's exactly how it operates in China, because if you have a low social credit score, it's just like our credit score for, you know, our financial credit score. You go in for a bank loan and or you want to buy a car or go to a university or whatever it might be, well, they're going to look at your financials and decide whether whether you're worthy of that credit. And so they, Facebook, and she actually has it in the index. You can see the exact patent that they tried to file, and the only reason why they backed off is because the Federal Trade Commission threatened regulatory intervention at the time. However, although this is beyond the scope of my discussion right now, Zuboff does talk about this in her book, about the tactics of these big tech companies and the way that they will, you know, they'll attempt things on the front end. It's so unprecedented, it might be rejected, but eventually they figure out how to normalize it. And then the very thing that at one time people thought, no way, they're actually doing. Okay, let me keep moving on here. So really, I contend that the worst part of the China system isn't the social credit system, although it's deplorable, but it's the infrastructure behind it. It's the system of surveillance, of data harvesting, and total knowledge, which is used to control the Chinese people. In an Atlantic article by Ross Anderson entitled "The Panopticon is Already Here," he says, and this is about the Chinese surveillance system, the social credit system, the whole thing. He says, until recently, it was difficult to imagine how China could integrate all of these data into a single surveillance system, but no longer. So basically, you know, for a while there was skepticism, even though we knew that they had this system. The idea was there's no way they have the ability to take all of that information in and basically synthesize and integrate it into one central place. But he says in 2018, a cybersecurity activist hacked into a facial recognition system that appeared to be connected to the government and was synthesizing a surprising combination of data streams. The system was capable of detecting Uyghurs by their ethnic features. Okay, I'm going to pause there. If you haven't heard of the Uyghurs, they live in the northwest part of China. And there's a lot of talk about them, but the mass media tries to hush it because it's a Muslim population, and they have been extremely persecuted by China, where they've placed up to 2 million of them in prison camps. Many of them have been killed, used for harvesting organs so that rich people can get, you know, the organ of their choice, as in, like, I need a new kidney and I'll just fly over there and get a new one, and we just get it fresh out of one of these Uyghurs. And that's why there are many people that have pushed and called for boycotting the Olympics. That's not the only reason. We've got a lot of issues with China, but this is a glaring one. There have been many basketball teams, because NBA is so connected with China, that have been called on the floor about this. Recently, there was a CEO, I can't remember his name. He's also a co-owner or part owner in the Golden State Warriors, and he made some deplorable comments about the Uyghurs. Well, nobody cares about the Uyghurs. Why are you asking me about the Uyghurs? But it's a population where what they do is they sterilize the women, and also many women testify of being sexually assaulted, and many of these people end up dead or disappear. You know, nobody sees them again, but they use them for slave labor. There are a lot of things that we use here in the West. For all we know, our iPhones are made by them. We know that they use them for building solar panels and all these, you know, green initiatives that are going to benefit the planet. So that's my little side note on the Uyghurs. It's Uyghur. So it's kind of difficult spelling, but look it up and learn a little bit about the Uyghurs. So he says, the system was capable of detecting Uyghurs by their ethnic features, and it could tell whether people's eyes or mouths were open, whether they were smiling, whether they had a beard, whether they were wearing sunglasses. It logged the date, the time, the serial numbers, all traceable to individual users of Wi-Fi-enabled phones that passed within its reach. It was hosted by Alibaba and made reference to CityBrain, an AI-powered software platform that China's government has tasked the company with building. So the article also, there's a few other interesting, it's a really great article, it's real long, but there's also, I just wanted to read this because it talks about the potential use of mass data harvesting, as in where this thing could go very easily, where China's definitely taking it, but it could go globally as well. So it says, they could tap the cameras attached to rideshare cars or the self-driving vehicles that may soon replace them, automated vehicles may be covered in a whole host of sensors, including some that will take in information much richer than 2D video. Data from a massive fleet of them could be stitched together and supplemented by other city brain streams to produce a 3D model of the city's of the city that's updated second by second. Each refresh could log every human's location within the model. Such a system would make unidentified faces a priority, perhaps by sending drone swarms to secure a positive ID. Now, this whole idea that he mentions about the 3D modeling, that's a service. I can't remember what it's called. I saw an advertisement for it recently from Amazon where they're offering that service to businesses where they can actually 3D model your entire building, your business. And that's the ultimate vision of this thing. I'm sure Meta, the whole idea of the metaverse, operates on the same idea. It's like the Matrix. There's a lot to be said there, but I'm going to keep reading. There's a little bit more. He says, the model's data, speaking of the 3D model, the model's data could be time-synced to audio from any networked device with a microphone, including smart speakers, smartwatches, and less obvious Internet of Things devices like smart mattresses, smart diapers, and other things like that. All of these sources could coalesce into a multi-track location-specific audio mix that could be parsed by polyglot algorithms capable of interpreting words spoken in thousands of tongues. This mix would be useful to security services, especially in places without cameras. China's iFlytek is perfecting a technology that can recognize individuals by their voice print. Okay, so now let me circle back around to the idea of a social credit system in the United States. Although Zuboff doesn't talk about ESGs, like I mentioned earlier, she does, as far as I could tell, I couldn't find anything about ESGs. It's already a reality that's developing in the financial sector just under the hood of our bank accounts. Now, from what I understand, ESGs stand for Environmental Social Governance Scores. And right now, it's being used mostly in the financial sector and really to monitor businesses. So it's a score that businesses and banks and financial institutions are placing on one another, and there's this whole system. It's kind of complicated. But ultimately, the consumer will have an ESG score. And some banks, from what I understand, Merrill Lynch, if you were to look at your financials, if you have investments with them, you might find an ESG score connected there. You know, and ultimately, it's kind of a woke score. It's like, what's your carbon footprint? How environmentally friendly are you? What's your social score? So ultimately, for an individual, would be like the social credit score. And also governance, I know at least one aspect of that having to do with companies has to do with, you know, how many minorities do you have on your board? How many indigenous people? All these different elements that, you know, there's a lot to be said about those ideas, and I'm not going to go into it right now. But this is from Glenn Beck, just put out a book on the Great Reset and does an excellent job pulling together a lot of resources. And he's talking about ESGs. He says here in his book, according to a report by KPMG, thousands of companies located in more than 50 countries already have ESG systems in place, including 82% of large companies in the United States. Okay, so if 82% of large companies, big corporations in the US, already have these in place, they're not spending that money for nothing. That is having an impact on our society, and eventually it will go mainstream. Further, he says in his book, American financial institutions have already built massive ESG databases to track and even predict companies' ESG scores. Moody's database has more than 140 million company ESG scores, covering 220 countries, and it now sells a tool to help banks, corporations, and other institutions predict the ESG scores of small and medium-sized companies around the world, including countless companies that have never once submitted ESG data or reports. That means if you don't turn an ESG report into Moody's, it might invent one for you whether you like it or not. So this thing is taking hold. You change the infrastructure, then you change the way things are done. So currently, beyond the ESGs, many companies and banks have even engaged in canceling clients based on their political views. So you go back to Trump, and when he was, aside from the fact that he was banned from all social media, and yet Ayatollah Khomeini and the Taliban can all operate on there. They can call for the death and the murder of millions and all kinds of things like that. But we have a former president that, even if people don't like him, it's there are greater principles at stake. Like, we're talking about a free society with liberal values where you have free speech, and he's not allowed to be on social media. And then, of course, there's the idea as well, you know, they're private companies. Well, there are lots of arguments back and forth on that. But it wasn't just that. There were, I can't remember the bank off the top of my head, but, you know, obviously Trump was a capitalist, he big businessman, and there was at least one big bank, and I want to say Stripe also did this with them, where they canceled tons of their accounts and said, hey, you know, we won't do business with you, it's bad for us. And so that happened. Then there's General Michael Flynn, the three-star general. He's got a really bad name, bad reputation, but he's a great guy, and it was a big lie. He was framed, the whole deal. So if you go look it up, fact check, I guarantee you're going to get bad information, but Michael Flynn really is an upstanding guy, and I'm not going to go into that story. Either way, there's no reason why banks like Chase Bank should be able to send him a letter and say, hey, this is what they actually said. After careful consideration, we decided to close your credit cards on September 18th, 2021, because continuing the relationship creates possible reputational risk to our company. Now, that is not acceptable in my opinion, but that's the result of creating a society where we're cultivating this social credit deal. We should have banks that they're not paying attention. I mean, unless it's like a terrorist or something. But the problem here is this is all political. It's just political enemies. And there's a lot I could say there. Another one just recently, it was just a few days ago, I saw Mike Lindell, the owner of MyPillow. I don't pay attention to the guy. I know he says a lot of wacky things. Some of the things I don't disagree with him on, but for the most part, I don't know. I think he's just a real character. And yeah, it doesn't matter. The point is that the bank that he banks with said that they were going to cancel all of his accounts. And so this kind of stuff has been going on. It's not just with this guy. It's been happening to many people where they're getting canceled for supposedly being a threat to this company's reputation. You've got to be kidding me. So I'm just going to end with this, because those are social ramifications. And for right now, we might think, well, I don't like that guy. You know, I don't like Trump. I don't like, what about Parler? Parler, that was a huge deal. After the Capitol riots, Parler was a social media company, and they had been around, I want to say, for a couple years and had grown. It was a very successful small startup, and it wasn't really known as a conservative outlet, but that's where all the conservatives started going when they started getting canceled and booted off of Twitter, because it was literally happening, which is crazy because Twitter claims that, you know, that they don't want to have a echo chamber, and yet that's what they do, is boot people off. But then when that happened, they went after Parler. And so Apple, Google, and Amazon, well, it was Apple and Google and one of the other app stores, they basically canceled their app so that they couldn't sell their app on the store. And then Amazon came out and said, we will not host their website, because, you know, Amazon is also a host. And so they literally couldn't run their platform. But then they went to platform after platform, different companies, and they all said, no, we will not allow you. And the accusation was that they had been used to coordinate the January 6th riots. Well, really, these are just really big capitalists that were very jealous, and they took advantage of knocking down the little guy. It turns out that, you know, Facebook, Twitter were far more used for January 6th and actually has far more violent stuff on it than Parler does in the first place. Either way, the damage was done and they destroyed the company. I think it's maybe kind of made a comeback, but it'll never be what it was. So we can think, well, I don't care because I don't like those guys, or, you know, these companies have the right to do that. But I'm just going to leave you with this. This is from Martin Niemöller after or during World War II. And he said, first, they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me. And there was no one left to speak for me. Okay, I'm gonna let you guys go, and I'll be back next time with another riveting episode with Anti-Visions. See you guys.